From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Lisa C. is my guest. Her latest novel, Dreams of Joy, was a number one bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list. I've been reading her brilliant history of her own Chinese-American family, On Gold Mountain, originally published in 1995 and now in a new edition. Lisa C., welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
On Gold Mountain, it's really wonderful. I'm so happy that I read it and joined the ranks of your millions of admirers. Why did you decide to republish it now?
Well, you know, it's never been out of print, but about a year ago, my cousin, Leslie, found some letters that were written to my great-grandmother, Ticey, and in many ways, they really changed a lot of the story. And along the way, over the last 17 years, I had learned some other things about the family, but also had taken a lot of what I had learned about the family and used it in different ways. And so I called the editor and I said, you know, the 20th anniversary is going to be coming eventually. Maybe I could do an updated version. And she said, oh, that's just so far away from now. You know, let's talk about it in a couple of years. But then she called and said, you know, about 2 months later, and she said, oh, let's just do it now. So it's kind of funny. It's 17 years later. It doesn't really tie into any kind of fun anniversary. But
the big 17th anniversary, we always celebrate those.
Yes.
It's Chinese tradition, I believe, to celebrate the 17th anniversary.
So. I don't know about that.
Well, I'm glad you did, and it really is wonderful. It's a great book. But help me a little bit with it. It's the history of your family, and it starts, I guess, with your great-great-grandfather. Right. But maybe you could work backwards from you to where it starts.
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
I always go the other direction.
I know, so go.
I'll try to go backwards.
Okay.
So, you know, I grew up in this very large Chinese-American family here in Los Angeles. I lived with my mother, but I spent a lot of time with my father's family in Chinatown. I have red hair and freckles, so I don't look very Chinese. But I have about 400 relatives here in Los Angeles. There are about a dozen that look like me, the majority still full Chinese, and then this spectrum in between. And when I was a girl and I would spend time with my grandparents and great aunts and uncles in the family store, they would tell these wonderful stories about my great-grandfather, about my great-grandmother. And these, you know, were very kind of romantic stories in many ways, also very adventurous, but also filled with a lot of heartache. And so I think that I always connected to those stories, but also to the place, you know, this family store that had started really with my great-great-grandfather, who was an herbalist and opened an herb shop in Sacramento. And then later, crotchless underwear for brothels, and then curios, and finally into antiques. And, you know, that store is still in business today. It's one of the oldest continuously run, what do you call it, you know, family-owned businesses in the state. But one of the things about the store was that they had some odd ideas about having a business, running a business, one of which was never sell anything. So there were these very large things, big pieces of temples that when my great-grandparents went to China, you know, they would go into villages and they would say things like, you know, we like your temple, we'll buy it. And they would, and they'd take it apart and bring it back here to Los Angeles, put it all back together. And then now it's almost 100 years that they have been renting out a lot of those big temple pieces for films, you know, beginning with the silent movies. So as a child, I was around this beautiful stuff, and it wasn't just like little vases. You know, these were big things, big marriage beds and giant statues and these, again, huge temple carvings. And it was a very romantic place, as I said, but you felt like you were in a completely different world, and that world doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, the store is there, the things are there, but the people are no longer there. That meant so much to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, we were going to talk last week, but you got caught in Los Angeles freeway traffic for a couple of
hours. Boy, did I ever.
So you've been in L.A. a while. It's changed a lot in the time that you've been there.
Yes, it certainly has. You know, my great-grandparents came here to Los Angeles in about 1897, and we've been here ever since. And, you know, there are these places, you know, like the Family Store, actually, which was in this last building of what was called China City. And China City was one of the early tourist attractions here in Southern California. I think many of your listeners have probably, if they've come to Los Angeles, have gone to Alvera Street, which was supposed to be this, you know, authentic Mexican marketplace. And
right.
If you've been there, you know it's not too authentic, but it has a certain kind of charm. Well, right across the street, the same woman, Christine Sterling, built another tourist attraction called China City. And it was supposed to be this, you know, kind of authentic Chinese city, one square block surrounded by a miniature Great Wall, and inside it was built from the leftover sets from the filming of The Good Earth. So not terribly authentic, but it had a certain kind of charm. And it was also a quite ill-fated place, and after a series of fires, after 10 years, it closed. But there was one building that remained. And it was into that building that my family moved the store. And so, you know, that store that I was talking about, it had all these little rooms, what had once been the shops of China City. And also these sort of hidden corners, hidden alcoves that had these kind of skeletal remains of China City, the old China City Wishing Well, the old China City Goldfish Pond. Well, today there isn't a single brick left of China City or even just a lot of the other places from Southern California. You know, we don't have a great respect for history here. If you can put up another strip mall, let's do it, you know. So a lot of those old buildings, theaters, things like that have been torn down. And so much of what I've been writing about over the years is a way for me to go out and talk to people who, you know, may have had shops and restaurants in China City, may have, you know, not many of them left, then their children, even their children in their 70s, 80s, 90s, people who, you know, went through Angel Island, all these kinds of stories, and try to capture them before the memories disappear as well.
Yeah, it's we're talking with Lisa C., and she's the author of many books, including the fabulous On Gold Mountain. And it's like a time machine, On Gold Mountain. We really travel with you back 100 years. So, again, I still want to get I want to get it straight in my own head, so I'm going to make you go backwards again. So
okay.
your parents are...
Right. So my parents are Richard C. and Carolyn C. My mother is a writer. My father is an anthropologist. They've been divorced since I was 3. They were only the second couple in our whole extended family to be married legally in the United States. It was against the law for Chinese and Caucasians to marry here in California until 1948.
So you're the product of this evil miscegenation.
Yes. Well, of generations of it.
Yeah.
My grandparents, they went to Mexico to get married. And then my great-grandparents...
So now your grandparents were also...
Grandfather, Eddie, was half Chinese, and my grandmother, Stella, was just, you know, kind of an orphaned girl who, when she was 16, met this Chinese boy and his family. And I think she saw in them the thing that she didn't have, which was true family. And I think that's true for all three generations. My mother, my grandmother, and my great-grandmother were all orphaned in different kinds of ways. And I think that they, when they, you know, kind of fell into this family, they saw it, and at least for some of them, it was the one thing that they were looking for. You know,
so you're
solid family.
You're one-eighth Chinese, is it?
Yes, that's right.
But now your great grandmother Taisi in this story, she considers herself Chinese even though she's not even a single bit Chinese.
I think for my grandmother as well. I think over time, and of course, you know, when they did marry these Chinese men, they were really separated from their families, separated from the rest of the, you know, larger white culture. They couldn't live outside of Chinatown. Their children, you know, in the early days couldn't go to regular schools because the schools were segregated as well. So it was, you know, it was by marrying someone who was Chinese, you really were kind of ostracized. And in fact, for about 10 years, there was a federal law that if you married someone who was Chinese, you would lose your American citizenship. Neither my great-grandmother or my grandmother were affected by that. Partly because my great-grandmother, what they did, my great-grandparents, was they went to a lawyer who drew up a contract between two people as though they were forming a partnership. So they weren't even, you know, married in the traditional sense of the word or legal sense of the word, so she didn't lose her citizenship.
And was that, did that turn out to be a good thing or a bad thing for Taisi?
That she didn't lose her citizenship?
No, that she wasn't legally married.
It was just what it was, huh? I think it was what it was, and, you know, while they were married, they were definitely married. They had 5 children and 5 stores, and they traveled all around together, and they had all kinds of adventures. And they were married for 20-some years. But then when they went back to China on a buying trip, just, you know, buying, again, going into the villages and buying things, bringing them back. And while they were there, my great grandfather started buying up things that he couldn't have here. You know, so he bought a factory that made firecrackers, another one for baskets, another one for ceramics. He built the first Western-style hotel in the big town near his home village, the Fatsan Grand Hotel. And then in his home village, a village which then and even today only has about 300 people, he built the house that he couldn't own here. And it's funny because it's sort of 1919. It looks like a Star Trek, you know, that somebody kind of picked up a kind of Southern California Spanish-style house with a tile roof and beamed it across the Pacific and dropped it into this tiny village. And it's still there today. And the problem with having all of that there was that he wanted someone to take care of it, and he thought that person should be my grandfather, Eddie, who was just 14 years old. And Taisi didn't want the family to separate. She traveled back to Los Angeles, didn't think too much about it. She was a pretty independent woman. And then a few months later, she intercepted a letter written to her brother-in-law, took it to a letter reader in Chinatown, and found out that her husband, who was in his 60s, had just married a 16-year-old girl. And that really was the end of the marriage, although they did live across the street from each other basically for the rest of their lives. And I think Fongxi, my great-grandfather, my father always says, oh, he was just a horny old man. But but actually, you know, he was sort of following the Chinese tradition. You know, you become a wealthy man. This is a way that you show your wealth and you show your strength in the village, and he was the head man of his village. And so it really was sort of culturally appropriate for him. It just wasn't really going to fly for Taisi. You know, it just really wasn't, because I don't think there's a woman around who, as she's going into her 60s, wants to see her husband with a 16-year-old bride.
No, I can.
That just might be me. I don't know.
I think. But I guess people didn't, you know, I mean, when we think about someone taking a 16-year-old bride, we think that's just, you know, crazy and wrong and illegal or whatever. But, you know, people didn't live quite as long, and people, I guess Chinese people, like you said in your book, that when Fongxi was 14, he was already
on his own.
On his own. And
right. And you know, I think in Chinese culture, that was a pretty standard age, actually, for girls. And it might even be pushing on the high end of age for when girls would be married.
My mother was married when she was 17, although,
yeah.
And her husband was 21, which, again, nowadays I think people go, what? That's crazy.
Yeah, I know. Well, we live in a different time.
Yeah. You know, when the Nazis took power in Germany in the 1930s, they passed a series of laws that criminalized the normal behavior of Jews so that Jews would be seen as criminals and therefore hated. And when I was reading On Gold Mountain, I got the feeling that the Nazis got their ideas from the treatment of the Chinese in the United States.
Well, I don't know if that's so, but there are a lot of similarities, and it is true that it's only the United States, Nazi Germany, and South Africa that have denied citizenship based solely on race. And so, you know, thankfully we got over it.
Yes.
But a lot of those laws that happened here in California, you know, some of them were very local, too. You know, that would have to do with just a town, you know, just any little town in California where they might place a special tax on laundrymen. You know, so if you had a laundry that had a roof and running water, you didn't pay a tax. But if your laundry was a wash tub, a washboard, and some soap and some line and some clothespins, they would really tax you. So these were things that could be very local. Some of them were just in the state, and then some of them were actually national laws, like the Chinese Exclusion Act, or you know the thing that you couldn't become citizens, things like that. So it really was a very difficult time for Chinese who lived here. And actually, just today, I spoke to a group of Brandeis women, and there was a rabbi there who also had a book out, and she and I were talking about the same thing, these similarities of the experience of what happens to people. And you know, you could say the same thing about slavery in this country. You know, these laws that and the denial of rights to people that now we can look back and think, how could that have happened? But it is very much a part of our history.
Yeah, and a kind of an ugly part when you really, I mean, don't even have to look at it very closely for it to be ugly.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, what were some of the laws, not just the taxing, but they were very repressive Chinese, anti-Chinese or anti-Oriental laws?
Right. Well, so for example, the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 barred the immigration of all Chinese immigrants to this country except for four categories: if you were a minister, a student, a diplomat, or a merchant. And, you know, all of these things, there's always a way to get around them, right? I mean, mm-hmm. That's, everybody's looking for the loophole. And so with that, there's only, you know, of those four categories, there's only one you can fake, and that's being a merchant. You know, can't fake being a student, can't fake being a diplomat or a minister. My great-grandfather, he was a lot of things, but he was a legitimate merchant. He owned his own business. He didn't have any actual partners. However, he did have a partnership list. And I found at the National Archive, you know, about 500 pages of interrogations, boarding passes, health certificates, photographs of my family.
Wow.
And in there were these forms that had to be sent every 6 months, where my great-grandfather would say who his partners were. So these were just partners on paper, what they called paper partners. These were people who paid him anywhere from $50 to $500 so that he would put them on his list as these are my partners so that they would be able to come in. And that was how he brought in a lot of people, sort of circumventing the law. And then those paper merchants were allowed to bring in their wives. So then they were able to bring in their wives and children. So, you know, there were a lot of terrible laws, but people found a way to get around them in many instances. You know, I think another very good example of what we're talking about is the difference between Ellis Island and Angel Island. So Angel Island is in San Francisco Bay. It was considered the Ellis Island of the West Coast. It opened very specifically to keep the Chinese out. Even though there were people from other countries who came through, the main purpose was to keep the Chinese out. And at Ellis Island, people would answer, you know, it was difficult. People talk about how hard it was. They had to go through their medical exam. They had to answer a standard 20 questions. People, you know, have written about and talked about how humiliating that was. At Angel Island, people had, Chinese, had to answer anywhere from 200 to 1,000 questions. And they would be detained for sometimes days, weeks, months, up to 2 years before they would, you know, either be allowed to land, were deported back to China, or in many instances, people committed suicide. So, you know, this was a kind of a relentless experience from the moment you landed, you know, from the moment you got off the boat at Angel Island, and how people showed their endurance and persistence and this great desire to become Americans. I mean, you know, we do live in a country of immigrants, and people come from, you know, all over the world. You know, this is something we share in, that we all have someone in our families who was scared enough, brave enough, crazy enough, dumb enough to leave their home countries to come here. And some people at different times, you know, experienced real hardship. The Irish, Italians, you know, people who were obviously kidnapped in Africa and sold as slaves. You know, this is something that is part of our history, and it does come and go in waves. And one of the things that I've been very proud of about On Gold Mountain, and again, you know, it's been out 17 years, so I have some history here about this, is that I've had these experiences where I've gone to a high school class or a university class, and to see how kids of very different backgrounds respond to the book. You know, they themselves may come from, you know, may just be the first generation born here. So they really have that sense of the immigrant experience. And they can look and see, oh, this, you know, I think my group is the worst one off. But then you read about other groups and you think, oh, maybe it's, you know, I wasn't just so targeted myself or my group. And that I think it helps to build some understanding about that experience that people, you know, that all of us somewhere in our family had somebody who went through that.
On Gold Mountain is a nonfiction book, but you sort of took a novelist approach to the book. I mean, there's certain scenes that really play like scenes from a novel or even a movie. And there's one chapter in which you write in the voice of
Anime Wong.
Yeah. Is that right? I mean, is it a novelist approach?
You know, the first chapter is called The Wonder Time. And I say, you know, I sort of go through the whole chapter. And at the end, I said, well, this is what some people think, but here are some other versions that I heard. Except for that chapter, and there are a couple of other places where I'll say, you know, and here's another version. But I tried to, you know, to talk to as many people as I could about the same incident, the same thing that had happened. I also had the immigration files, you know, those 500 pages of documents that could really back up what people said or change what people said. With the two chapters, the one about Anime Wong and the one about Tyrus Wong, the artist, who is still alive, 101 years old.
Wow.
Still flying kites. He was the artist who drew Bambi for Disney, and you know, he's one of those great Disney animators, and he's still just going strong and just an incredible person. But I had grown up hearing him tell stories. So this, and of course I recorded him so many times before I wrote that.
Yeah.
So he really was just, to me, I just feel like he was just speaking in his own voice.
Yeah.
With anime, it was a little different. She was one of my grandfather's closest friends. I have some of her clothes in my closet.
Wow.
And I kept calling her brother to interview him. And he'd say, yes, let's get together on Tuesday. And then he'd call on Tuesday morning, say, oh, no, I don't want to, I'm sick, whatever. And he kept putting it off. And that went on for about 2 years. And then finally one day he said, I just don't want to participate in this. And, in that family, they had always been very, they loved her, but they were very conflicted about what she did, because being a performer for a woman, it's like, especially in the old days, seen as sort of one step above being a prostitute. But also, as time has gone by, people have been very critical of her as sort of being the person who invented that stereotype of the dragon lady in the movies, or either the dragon lady or that sort of crazy sexy lady. and she's had a kind of a bum rap, actually, because she was such a groundbreaker, really, and there still to this day is no one who could compare to her in terms of in this country, a Chinese American actress, who's had that kind of success.
Yeah.
And so I have to say I was just very upset. I was very upset, and I was talking to my mom, and I said, nobody asked Anna May what she thought. Nobody asked her. She didn't have that opportunity. And as I was saying that to her, I thought, oh, this is how, this is, because I hadn't planned on writing a chapter just from her perspective. But I got off the phone, and that was the first line of that chapter, nobody asked me. And then I went out and I found all of these things that she had written that are in the Motion Picture Academy Library. And I was able to sort of piece together something that really was from her voice, of all of the from all the different interviews, from the things that she had written during the war. And so maybe it has a novelistic feel to it, but in fact, those are all her words, except perhaps that one first sentence, which was mine, because I felt bad that nobody asked her what she thought.
Well, that particular chapter is just one little gem in this marvelous book that everybody should go get on Gold Mountain, and it's in a new edition with a wonderful new little epilogue from you. And now I guess you're probably writing a novel because you've written so many great ones. You're in the middle of a new one.
Yes, I am.
Well, when you're done with it, will you come back and talk to us again on From the
Bookshelf? Absolutely. I would love it.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, Lisa C. on Gold Mountain. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or check us out on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Lisa C., author of On Gold Mountain, for being here this week. Thank you so much, Lisa C. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.